If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Welcome back to Misunderstood for your bonus episode on Sunday night. I am your host, Rachel Yucatel. Okay, so guys, this episode actually aired a couple months ago, but the story is back in the news of the Delphi murders. And so I wanted to bring you this episode again in case you had missed it, because it's such a good and informative interview with Susan Hendricks, who wrote the book on it. And it has been a journalist covering the Delphi murders since the beginning. So just to give you a little bit of background, on February 14th, 2017, the bodies of Abigail Williams and Liberty German were discovered on a bridge called the High Bridge in part of the Delphi Historic Trails in Delphi, Indiana, after the girls had disappeared from the trail the previous day. So they were found about a day later. The murders have received extensive media coverage, in part due to the video and audio recordings released by law enforcement that came from one of the girls' smartphones, which recorded an individual believed to be the killer. He says something in the recording. He says, down the hill, like telling the girls to get down the hill. And later you come to realize there's, you know, for 5 years, no one found out any information and it was kind of a cold case. And 5 years later, recently, about a year ago, somebody was arrested, a guy named Richard Allen. He was, you know, sought out and they thought that he was what people call bridge guy. And there's all sorts of conspiracy theories. I just want to say that he's not the bridge guy. He's not the guy that killed them. He's not the person that told them to go down the hill. There are all sorts of other things, especially going on now in the news. The defense was saying there's a third party option out there, that there are pagan killings, pagan rituals that went on, and that's how they died. And it's not from Richard Allen. There's also someone named Ron Logan, who owned the property that people really believe, and I'm going to have a guest on Friday. He's a conspiracy theory guy. You know, I don't know what he's going to say, but he says we've got it all wrong. The person in jail is not the sole person that committed this crime, and he's not bridge guy. But anyway, Susan knows exactly what she's talking about. She's been writing about this for years. Her book is amazing. You got to get it if you want to find out more about the Delphi murders. But she's been in touch with the family. She knows the family. She's been there, and she was in trial last week, and she saw everything that happened. So without further ado, I'm going to bring you this episode. It's great. If you're into true crime, you're going to love it. She literally gives you all the details. So like, get some popcorn, guys. Get some soda, wine, whatever you drink, because you're going to love this. This is juicy. Enjoy my episode with Susan Hendricks. Hi, everyone. It's Rachel Yucatel from the Misunderstood podcast. podcast, and I wanted to give a shout out to our sponsor, Holistic Goddess. Holistic Goddess is a one-stop shop for all your holistic health needs. They offer a wide range of products, from castor oil packs and collagen to natural bug spray. They do the hard work for us, checking ingredients and investigating where each product is made so you can focus on finding what works for you. Holistic Goddess brings on recognized brands weekly, often focusing on women-owned brands in North America, and they personally try all the products before adding them to the store. It's always exciting to see what new products they'll feature next. If you're looking for reliable health solutions that keep the unique needs of women in mind and cater to all ages and stages, definitely check out Holistic Goddess. And for 15% off, use code UNDERSTOOD. Go to www.holisticgoddess.com and again, use code UNDERSTOOD for 15% off. Susan, thank you so much for joining me on Misunderstood in Boca. Thank you for flying in. I so appreciate it.
It's so good to be here. I feel like I haven't seen you in a long time. And I know that you follow true crime, obviously, and I follow your show. So it's an honor to be here.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's funny because the last time I saw you and the only time I really met you was at your wedding.
At my wedding.
Which is so random. And I was invited by someone I had known from Vegas, and it's actually embarrassing. I can't even remember the guy's name.
Doug.
That's right. Hi, Doug. But he was so kind, and I had known him in Vegas very, like, peripherally, not at all. And somehow I got invited to your wedding. It was such a fun event, but it was like this very weird, random invite because we really didn't know each other.
I've gone to weddings like that before.
Which were really fun.
They're fun.
But oddly enough, like, I had no connection with him, really, so that was what was uncomfortable. I feel like I connected more with you and your husband or the people at the wedding, and he was like face down drunk by the end of it. So that's all I remember.
Sorry, Doug.
And I don't think I ever spoke to him again, but I really like him. I think he's a great guy.
But I'm so glad that you went because I was able to meet you.
Yes, it was great. Okay, so I want to get into this book that is out that you've written. But before we get into that, I really want to know, you know, people, when they look at you, recognize your face and recognize your voice and feel so comfortable with you because you've been doing this for so long. But rarely do we know the person behind who we're always looking at and getting our news from and that we trust so much. So my first thing for you is I want to know how you got into this because I feel like people think they know you, but they don't.
And that's a good question. I was in college, and I think maybe it's evolving and changing. I hope so, that you have to have it all figured out when you're that age. I didn't. I was at Arizona State, and my roommate, though, was in the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism, and I was signing up for the next semester classes, and I ended up taking a communications course with her because she was in it. And the more courses I took, the more I started to think, I could do this. I want to do this. Mm-hmm. And Walter Cronkite, when I was in college, came to speak. And it was a packed room, of course. He didn't have to necessarily be in that class. But for me to hear him and for him to talk about being a part of history, and I know my grandmother, I mean, everyone, there were like four channels, and that's what you had to watch. And I remember witnessing when he announced that the president was dead. And that hooked me in terms of being a storyteller and being able to be a part of history.
Right. But I read in your book that you were essentially really shy.
Oh, extremely shy.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm giving you the college. Okay. So that's I knew what I wanted to do. Did I know that I could do it? No. And it was so strange because growing up in New Jersey with my parents and their friends and growing up with their kids, my mom's good friend's son said to me, I didn't know you were at CNN. I didn't even know you could talk until you were 10. Because I hid behind my mom's leg, and my older sister is very outgoing, so I was able to kind of hide behind her.
Yeah,
I was an introvert and shy and would open up once I really got to know people. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, then why would you go into that field? Well, I soon realized that it's very different than public speaking.
Yeah.
Once you get used to doing it initially, it's really just an innate object that you're talking to the camera and connecting. Mm-hmm. And by no means was I good out of the gate. I mean, my first job was at a cable station in California. And the first story was lawn bowling at a retirement center. And I thought I made it. I'm on TV. I made it. It's lawn bowling. And I still have those VCR tapes with my eyebrows at a suit. Yeah. I was dressing the part. It was like 110 degrees, I remember, in Palm Springs, the KSQ affiliate, as a reporter. And I was out there ready to go dress for the part, but had a lot of learning to do.
Right, right. And are those things in the field, was it mostly you had to ad lib? Were you writing your own stuff back then?
Usually breaking news. So if there was a fire that broke out, they sent you and a photographer in the news van, and then you were on. And that's where I enjoyed that. It's the adrenaline of telling what's happening behind you and being able to interview people there on the spot. So a lot of breaking news. And then if it was a slow news day where there were some, they'd send me to a council meeting, I remember. Go find a story to council meeting. Uh-huh. And if you're not familiar with council meetings, they can argue about someone's fence and having it be an inch over them where it should be for hours.
Oh, gosh.
So it really is with limited resources, unless there were breaking news stories, the ability to tell a story. Mm. And I remember a colleague of mine as a reporter, he had been there a while. I was new and nervous. We went to a council meeting and I said, well, no one's here. No one's here. Let's go. And he said, well, isn't that the story? Don't always expect to go in and see the obvious story. What's the nuance here? What is the story? Why aren't people here?
Yeah.
And so that taught me a lot to say, look at things differently when telling a story.
Right. So how did you find yourself at HLN and CNN?
Well, I was in Palm Springs at the KSQ affiliate, and then I was a morning anchor at the NBC affiliate. And they asked me before I was hired, it was the competing station. And it kind of is like that movie Anchorman, where they want to pull you from the competing stations. Uh-huh. Have you anchored? I said, somewhat. And I was lucky that I was given that opportunity, but it was a morning show, 3 hours a day, every day. The guy, Gino Lamont, he's still there. He's now at the CBS affiliate, and we still keep in touch. It's funny. And my first day putting on a mic, they said, mic check, Susan, and I'm yelling at the top of my lungs. He's like, shh. And I thought, oh my gosh, here goes learning. And I was brutal out of the gate. And then you just had to get comfortable in your surroundings.
And it's also really hard to read a teleprompter.
It is not for me now, but it is then.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And everything made me nervous. I wasn't comfortable on the set in that area. I was more comfortable at that time in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my kind of safe space to be away and doing breaking news. But then I got this opportunity and I thought, okay, this is where I can be more myself a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that well-meaning news directors and people who are consultants would say, just talk to the camera like it's your mom. Well, what does that really mean? And it's funny, I've gotten to know Sanjay Gupta through the years, mm-hmm. working with him for years. And we were talking in the makeup room of all places. And I told him that story. And he said, well, that's funny, Susan, because he literally is, as you know, a brain surgeon, just a genius. But he said, I didn't know what I was doing. And they told me to have more energy on the air. And so he just kept smiling and talking really loud.
Right.
And they're like, stop smiling in his ear. It's not funny. So you don't really know. It's really what they're saying is the advice is be comfortable in your own skin.
Yeah.
And that's all that takes is reps and time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you do it out of the gate. How can you?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So how did you get into true crime and that being something that you started to cover more? Is that something you liked to cover? You found interesting?
And as you know, a story is a story no matter who you have on your podcast. They all have something to say or something to tell, a story from experience. And HLN was going in that direction.
Right.
I started when it was headline news, and then I was on Anderson Cooper's show for years doing cut-ins. And as soon as the Casey Anthony case hit, that is when we did wall-to-wall coverage.
Right.
I mean, you were watching it. It was unfolding. We knew all the attorneys' names, of course, Jose Baez, the opening statements. To me, it appeared as though, and it was, and I think that started back with O.J. Simpson and that trial.
Yeah.
Meaning people were glued to see what would happen, to understand, to have an opinion. Did she do it? Did she kill her daughter? And the numbers kept coming in.
Right.
People were watching, and Nancy Grace was at the network, and we practiced beforehand in terms of what we would do. We were on verdict watch when the verdict came down. And we knew to throw to Nancy Grace because she was there in the field.
Right. And she was known for covering top mom.
Yes,
top mom.
Yeah, at the top of her life.
I watched every night.
Yes. So my mom, her friends, I mean, what do you think?
And,
and then her parents on the stand, and it just really unbelievable as it was unfolding. it turns out the verdict came in when I was on the air. And they said, wow. go to Nancy, it's in. So I throw to Nancy Grace, and she says, we have a verdict. And we listened into the courtroom, not guilty. It was just stunning.
What did you think when they, did you expect that?
Well, luckily my father's an attorney, so I would call him and say, what do you think? What do you think of this? And what's this called, or what's that called? My cheat sheet, if you will. And he said, well, I think they might be overcharging her. So if you, that's a risk. And that's what I think happened. If you risk going for the death penalty, or if you risk,
right.
you risk them finding her not guilty because of that. Now,
right.
I don't know for sure, but I don't know what to think. It's hard when we found out that the body was discovered, that there was duct tape on skeletal remains. So it's like, was this, there's different opinions out there. Was this, and her giving her daughter chloroform mm-hmm. to go out at night, but then why the duct tape? Was this premeditated? Did she even do it? There are opinions out there. And it was unbelievable. And I threw it to Nancy Grace, and she said that famous line now, the devil is dancing. The devil is dancing to that.
Right.
I mean, it was infuriating for her because
yeah.
she believes that Casey got away with murder.
She had such an opinion. Yeah. I mean, I absolutely know exactly where I was when that verdict came in. I watched that trial. I watched before the trial. Of course, I had my own opinion. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, I was more stunned during those opening arguments or whatever mm-hmm. that Jose Baez did, and he changed the entire narrative.
Yes.
That was crazy to me.
Yes.
What I also have thought, you know, since then, I always think about the parents. Like, why did the father never say, that's not what happened. Right. I didn't do these things. I didn't sexually molest my daughter, you know, or the granddaughter, whatever they were alluding to.
And she was found in the pool the way
yes.
he presented that.
Right.
And I've learned through the years, then being a perfect example, you don't necessarily have to prove
right.
what's said in the opening statement.
Right.
So where was the proof that that happened?
And also that case was such a, you know, a testament to you can be guilty, but there's a way that you have to prove. You know, it's you have to prove the case.
Yeah, beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
Is there reasonable doubt?
Yeah.
And I think what really fascinated the viewer, and myself included, were the jailhouse calls mm-hmm. to her parents.
Yep.
Just there was so much there.
Yeah. And the behavior.
The lies.
Yeah.
The constant lies. Remember that police officer followed yeah. her to a fake job that she never had?
Right.
So
right.
what else is she lying
and
about?
As a parent, not... Mm-hmm. asking daily, yes. where is my daughter? I need to find my daughter. She was more worried about everyone's perception of her or, you know, so the media definitely portrayed her in a certain way, but she did it on her own,
you
in
know,
my opinion.
I felt bad for her mother.
Yeah.
And because she's the one that called the authorities and
yeah.
said, my daughter's trunk, it smells like a dead body.
Right.
If that doesn't point to Casey, I don't know what does.
Right.
And
then she kind of seemed to do an about face, right? And then kind of
yeah.
didn't, you know, stand up for the granddaughter.
And said, I did the searches.
Right.
I think in a way protecting her daughter.
Yeah.
Which
right.
we do see. But I really felt sorry for everyone involved here, of course, her daughter being killed. But the father, too, I think he fell into a depression after that, of course. Who
I'm
wouldn't?
Sure, yeah.
With the speculate, with the
right.
lies, the blatant lies. I say lies because were they ever proven?
Right. But I did think it was weird, as I said, that he's never come out and declared this was not true and mm-hmm. in a way that we all wanted him to
yes,
kind of you
right.
know
yes.
so anyway so obviously there are so many cases over the years that I'm sure struck a chord with you and you got involved in. How did this case that you wrote a book about, the Delphi murders, how did that come into your orbit at
yeah,
the beginning?
After Casey, as you know, mm-hmm. we followed the Jodi Arias trial,
of course, yeah,
with Travis Alexander, and it did make me reflect now after writing the book, thinking back to Travis Alexander's sisters
mm-hmm.
and the family. It's usually lost in the headline
yeah.
of Casey Anthony, of Jodi Arias, of O.J. Simpson, found not guilty. But mm-hmm. it's the names of the accused or the convicted, and rarely is it the family. So
yeah.
I was sent to Delphi. I remember covering it on the set and interviewing Ron Logan, the man who owned the property where the bodies were found.
Mm-hmm.
So I covered it there, and then they said, hey, we're sending you. This is about almost 2 years later. And I thought, oh, yeah, we cover so many cases that I thought, oh, that's the one with Libby who recorded the phone call. And early on, we called it Snapchat Murders. So that's when everything changed for me, when they assigned me that story.
Right. And so, but up until then, it wasn't something that was eating away at you. And I mean, it was like any other story where I know as a former journalist, you know, you get so many stories that come in, you really have to compartmentalize and you kind of have to end it when you end it and move on to the next one. Not only to protect yourself from really getting invested, but because there's just so much of that coming in at you and you kind of forget, by the end of the day, you've sort of forgotten what you've reported.
And
on.
The news cycle, as you know, it keeps churning and it keeps going.
Yeah.
And I had to say, oh, what story is Delphi? Oh, yes, with Libby and her family. And then I was reminded of the interview I did with Ron Logan and going there with a producer and spending 2 days there and meeting Libby's mom, Libby's grandfather, Libby's grandmother. It really changed my perspective.
Yeah.
And I got close with them. It didn't happen immediately. I was doing the interviews and then we went back and then they asked me to speak with them on a panel, to host a panel for them. So slowly but surely, I got close to them in a way that I hadn't been able to get with other families, whether it be for time constraint, meaning the news keeps going, keeps going, and I was never really there. I'd do a breaking story. And some people early on in my career would say, whatever happened to so-and-so? Well, rarely do we follow up on stories unless they get tons of attention. And that's the way the news cycle goes. And it's bothersome in a way because you don't really get to connect with the victims and the victims' families. And this was a time that I felt like I really did and had a story to tell from their perspective, not necessarily about, because we didn't know much throughout this crime. And for those listening and for those watching, it's a bizarre case in terms of how little information was let out. And I know that the authorities, they all had in mind the same goal of finding this guy on the bridge that Libby was able to record. But the secrecy or the lack there of information really alluded to a lot of speculation and even now conspiracy theories that, that keep going.
Well, I think what was interesting about them that you allude to in the book a lot of is that the investigators there really wanted to just report on the facts and they did not want to report on things until they knew it. And that created a lot of armchair investigators, a lot of people speculating exactly what you're saying. But for people listening, can we step back a minute and give the scene? Can you give the background of exactly what this case was?
Don't you wish everything was more rewarding? With Rakuten, almost everything is. You can earn cash back on those new shoes you've been wanting. You can save on the next trip you book. You can cash in on groceries. Just join. Shop your favorite brands and save. Sephora, Boots, Argus, Temu, Adidas, Trip.com. The list is long. Save online at over 550 stores. And when it's time to redeem those rewards, get your money exactly how you want it. Choose bank transfer or PayPal. So go ahead, take a trip, fill a cart. Get a new outfit. Rakuten is a world of rewards. Join today for free. Go to rakuten.co.uk or get the app. That's Rakuten.
Absolutely. It was February 13th, 2017, and Abby and Libby, best friends, 13 and 14 years old, Libby 14, Abby 13, had the day off from school. It was a makeup snow day. And it was abnormally warm for Indiana. When I went there and I saw the bridge, it was about 9 degrees. This day was in the 40s, but maybe felt a little warmer, maybe the mid to lower 40s, depending on who you ask at the time of day. And they asked Kelsey, Libby's sister, can you drop us off at High Bridge, is what it was called. It was an abandoned railroad track that was 62 feet high. It's still there. I mean, when you
unsturdy looking,
oh my gosh, it's terrifying. Yeah. It's terrifying. When you see the video of the guy on the bridge, it looks completely different, obviously, than it does in person. So she drops them off. She said to me, Susan, I had been saying no a lot to driving her sister places.
Yeah.
She thought, oh, I don't want to be the mean sister. Okay. All right, I'll drive you, but you have to get a ride home from Derek, their dad. And she said, okay. So they got ready that day. They had a sleepover. Abby was there. I think up most of the night giggling, as girls do that age, telling stories, spending time together. And Becky, Libby's grandmother, said to me, Susan, it was a way for them to be off electronics.
Yeah.
Just to be outside. I mean, I grew up going outside all the time, but kids now don't necessarily have that opportunity, especially when it's so cold that time of year.
Right. But going outside, it seems like almost like a fun thing that you normally wouldn't do. But there are, you know, also way it wasn't that long ago, but it seems like in that place, it was safe to do something like that. Like, yeah, I can't just let my daughter go off, especially in Manhattan, you know, and do things.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And even now, I mean, maybe it's because of the lot of work I'm in, but obviously times have changed. It's so different than, hey, come on when the streetlights go on. And that was, now I would be worried.
No,
she's out of my sight for 2 minutes in Target and I'm concerned. Right. But this was very safe and it's what kids did. Yeah. And so Kelsey drops them off. They wave goodbye. She says, I love you. Here, don't forget your jacket or your sweater. And that was the last time she ever saw them. So she drops them off and they walk down. It took us about, when I visited the bridge, about 5-10 minutes to get there from the trails. And authorities are piecing together what they know based on Libby's phone. So Libby took a picture of Abby and it was timestamped. Posted it on Snapchat, and that's the last communication. Derek, her dad, went to pick her up a little after 3. She didn't show up, kept calling her, got out of his car, and apparently tried to walk and find them. Right. And so that chunk of time, we also know what happened because Libby saw him, and her grandfather, Mike, was telling me, look, Susan, I think there was a vibe or creepiness she got from him, and she took the video and hit record. He was thinking that she would come home and say, Grandpa, look at this guy.
Yeah.
Look at this creepy guy on the bridge. Well, that never happened.
Right.
And the phone was discovered near their bodies.
Right.
A search ensued soon after. Maybe you don't think the worst right away, mm-hmm. especially a small town, less than 3,000 people. But people started to search. They got to their Facebook.
Very soon after.
Very soon.
It seemed, yeah.
And then it was
before
official.
Nightfall.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And then it was officially declared missing persons around, I think, 5:15, 5:30. Authorities are out there as well. Well, the search was called off, and there's been criticism of this, but I think it was officially called off because it's so dangerous down there. It really is. It's dense. There's a lot of brush. Can't really see. But the family members did say to me, it was so heartwarming to see so many flashlights in the glow of orange of people still staying. I mean, people searched overnight. And
how come they didn't send out dogs?
Sheriff Tob Lesenby told me, when I asked him about his biggest regret, he said it was canceling bloodhounds that were coming in from Michigan because this is such a small town.
Oh, right. They didn't have
Once them. Their bodies were discovered, he called that off. He said, I wonder now in hindsight, you know, being open about what he thinks he could have done. But everyone goes back in time, coulda, shoulda, woulda, on what you think you should do in that situation. But they never, Kelsey said, I never went there. Two young girls in the middle of the day murdered. No one went there.
Right. Because this town was not known for crime.
No, not at all.
This time,
And when you're there, it almost feels like a Pleasantville type of place with small homes, and they're separated by farmland. But it's just a place that you feel good being there. There's a main street. It feels right out of a storybook. And so no one really went there until, of course, their bodies were discovered that next day at noon by a searcher.
How did this hit mainstream media? Like, what made this case stand out? Was it because it was two young girls? Do you
think? I think so. And I think it was hearing this man's voice,
right,
where he said down the hill.
So how soon did they have this recording that they put out?
They had it as soon as their bodies were discovered, but it wasn't put out. First, it was a still shot. Mm-hmm. Also, a sketch was released based on witnesses who were there and saw a person walk by. So it was a sketch, a still picture, and then the audio of down the hill. Yeah. We didn't have guys. They added that in April of 2019, that extra word. Mm-hmm. But we do now know in hindsight, we didn't for the longest time, that there were 42 seconds on that phone that she recorded.
Right.
And based on court documents, it's alleged, because I haven't heard the recording, that Abby says something about, does he have a gun? So I think that's what drew all of the attention, were these two young girls putting yourself in their shoes or thinking it could be a daughter or someone you knew to be recording and to hear this man's voice. And that's when authorities said, we do believe the man on the bridge is the killer. So then the audience or the general public, everyone, they were pleading for their help with the sketch with the man on the bridge. And you would think a small town, less than 3,000, cut that in half. Let's say it's 1,000 men. And even less, a lot less in that age range, although it was broad, the age range, the longer the investigation went on. Where is he? Mm-hmm. You see him on the bridge. You see what he's wearing.
Yeah.
But going there, I had a different opinion from being on the set.
Right.
I thought everybody here dresses like this. That's right. Why. And the face is blurry. You can't see. Libby was far away. And then when she hit record, it was in her pocket. It was kind of muffled. But right. I think what they were hoping for and believing in, which who would blame them, the authorities, is someone knows this guy. Mm-hmm. Let's say it's your dad. Let's say it's your brother. Someone knows who that is and will call in. And that call never came.
Right.
Never came.
Well, and that, in my opinion, was such a good way to do it, but it's also such a local way probably to do it, right? Imploring for everyone's help. And that obviously backfired in some way because you got a lot of people, because now everyone's so into true crime, right? And they all think that they can come in and solve it with no credentials. Mm-hmm. And it started a lot of conspiracy theories. Yeah. Do you think that that hurt the investigation at any point or took away credibility?
It's hard to say because there's still things we don't know in terms of what exactly led to his arrest. We have learned since. So it had been almost 6 years.
Yeah. And they had made some people that were the head of kind of who they were looking at, right?
Yeah.
And they all one by one were never arrested.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit.
And
a
background of that, here's an example. When I first went there, I think I interviewed Detective Jerry Holman first. In that office, there's a sign that says, "Be quiet, the media could be listening." Mm-hmm. I mean, they were not saying a word in terms of cause of death. Even the family members didn't know. Mike did because he identified Libby's body, but wasn't saying much. The cause of death, of course, as I mentioned. So really nothing was being said. And Jerry Holman did say, look, there's no such thing as a cold case. And he said, we're on this because that had been 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then he mentioned that almost saying, Abby and Libby need you. If someone's capable of doing this, they could do it again.
Sure.
And pleading with the public. Now, I believe in hindsight, maybe they were just pleading to the person, a mom, a sister, someone, not necessarily everyone, the general public, because people started putting up side-by-side pictures of people that Kelsey went to school with. Like, oh, look, it's him. It's the sketch. Mm-hmm. And some of the tips were bizarre in terms of no details. Like, it's my cousin Steve, but he lives in Ohio, and that's it.
Right.
Or I saw this guy in a Greyhound. He looks like the sketch.
Right.
So it kept them busy because they really did go through every single sketch.
Right.
And they kept saying, notice any differences after the murder. Has he gained weight as he started drinking or doing drugs? Something off that's not really what that person would do. If so, call in.
Right.
And with that pleading came in just countless tips.
Right.
Tens of thousands kept coming in of random tips. So I remember they came back out and said, what is a good tip? Mm. This is it. If you know where they live, why you think it's them, not just a gut feeling that you saw them on a Greyhound, because they really couldn't do much.
But over the years, there were a couple people who were sort of lead suspects or whatever, who all seemed, if you looked at them individually, guilty. They could have been guilty. Yeah. They all were very suspicious.
And you could think, oh, well, he could be the guy in the fridge. I don't know. I mean, is it him?
Right. Why did they lie about the alibi? Yes. You know, there was all sorts of things, but it doesn't make them a murderer.
Weird kind of coincidences. Mm-hmm. And this is what I stuck to. And I felt bad throughout for law enforcement. And the superintendent, Doug Carter, said, look, I know this is difficult and I can't say what I think happened. I have to say what I know. Mm-hmm. So it would come up. I remember I was in Florida and I got a call that said, Inside Edition wants to talk to you, because I had met them there. I'd been there several times at that point. I said, well, why? And I believe it was at Daybell at that time. So it would, no, I'm thinking of another case. So it was Chad, I believe, he was arrested because he was a 9-year-old was in the neighborhood and he assaulted her, kidnapped her and put her in the basement. She was okay.
Right.
Well, it looked like he had a tattoo on his arm that could resemble Libby. So I texted Sheriff Tobe Lesenby and said, are you looking into him? Mm-hmm. It's very scripted because at this time the media attention started to grow and grow and he was getting an influx of calls. And he said, we're looking into them just like we'd look into anyone. So they would never call them an official suspect, but they would never say they weren't.
Right.
So they didn't leave anyone out, but they also didn't include anyone, which was even more vague. And Mike said something to me, because early on, Daniel Nations, that name came up. And he said, I got my hopes up and I was thinking this could be it. And it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And he said, I don't want to ride that roller coaster. So I'm going to wait till they call me and say, we got him.
Right.
Someone's charged with that. So throughout, there was a lot of speculation.
And even the guy you spoke about earlier, Ron Logan, was that his name, who owned the property? They looked at him for quite a while as well, right? He seemed a little off.
Yeah. And there were some leaked documents early on. Well, early on, the documents allowed for a search warrant on Ron Logan's property. That was soon after the murders, which you would assume that that's protocol because it was his property.
Yeah.
But the documents were leaked later on, and that's when we started covering all of that. And apparently he lied about his alibi that day, right. But he did have some prior run-ins with the law and right. was sentenced for driving on a suspended license. So I wonder if he has since passed away, sadly, of COVID, but I wonder if the lies or the cover-ups were for something completely different, it appears, obviously.
Right. It does appear. But that's why I was saying it doesn't make you a murderer, which you hear sort of used by defense a lot, that my client can be an asshole, my client can be terrible, you know, as a husband, but does not make them a murderer or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting. All right. So talk to me now about how we got to Richard Allen. You said that a lot of people, it's not really known how they actually came about him being the person that they arrested, or what do you know about
that? Soon after, and this is frustrating for a lot of people, including myself, thinking, what, he was there the whole time. Mm-hmm. Soon after the murders, either that day or the next day, he made himself available. He came forward mm-hmm. to an officer who took notes. It wasn't in a police station. I believe it was a parking lot of a grocery store, saying, I was there. I was on my phone looking at my stock ticker and looking at fish, mm-hmm. which sounds bizarre, but put himself there between 1:30 and 3:30. That since has changed, that timeline. But he put himself there, and whoever took the notes or took his, I guess, tip, looked at him more like a witness. I'm speculating here. Because no one intentionally would not want to follow up on this.
Right.
And then that was put away. Well, where was it?
Right.
So we now have his name. And of course, it's not blaming one particular person, but something did happen. And Indiana State Police came out and said, look, it was a misfiling mm-hmm. by the FBI. Well, then the FBI came out and said it wasn't our misfiling. Mm-hmm. So you could tell there was some, not as much cohesiveness as it appeared at first together in terms of their strategy.
And it also sorry to interrupt you, but it seems interesting to me because as if I was a journalist covering that and there was even the slightest notion that there was some sort of a witness or someone who had claimed to be there, that would have been a guest I would have wanted to talk to, right? And get all their insight on what they saw that day and what it was like. He would have become famous just being on the scene. So the fact that we didn't hear his name really until he got arrested seems really interesting.
And this man was a conservation officer. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much that plays into exactly his experience. Remember how small the town was.
Right.
And the Detective Holman, just a wonderful person and funny too. When I first arrived there, he said, I'm not going to talk to you. I don't feel like it. I said, okay. And he said, well, that was easy, and laughed. I mean, just really nice. There was a good vibe there in terms of law enforcement. And I really believe they truly obviously wanted to catch the person that did this. But I think obviously they were in over their heads in terms of maybe there was too many tips. And what was the system? Literally a filing cabinet? Mm-hmm. Or was it just put in a database where it shouldn't have been? Yeah. And the detectives did say to me in law enforcement, if nothing comes of this, we're starting over to the beginning. So I'm speculating here because we still don't know. Mm-hmm. Was it something they found later, or was it a tip from his wife, married more than 20 years, daughter who was married, walked her down the aisle? Mm-hmm. Was it something that she called in? And innocent until proven guilty, there is a group out there who says wrong guy, wasn't him. Mm-hmm. But former cold case investigator Paul Holes, who I've gotten close to, who's solved the Golden State Killer, essentially, said to me, and there's a chapter on Paul, and he talks about visiting the bridge and how he knew right away the guy was local mm-hmm. because of how casual he seems on that bridge. I'm scared of heights. I couldn't even step on it.
Right.
There's gaps. I'm surprised nothing happened to kids, but they have no fear, right?
Yeah,
when they're down there, and it's what they're used to.
But that's a good point, what you're saying. The way he was walking on it, he had clearly walked on it before.
And it's tough to find. It took us 15 minutes, and the CNN photojournalists were like, we can't get arrested. It says private property. Mm-hmm. We'll meet you down there. And I was with Kelsey, and I walked alone ahead for a little bit, and it felt very dense. And I know because I knew what happened down there, but still, it didn't feel like this open, airy trails that you may see in California. It was it was secluded. I could see how this would be, and that is what Paul speculated to, and based on his knowledge and going down there, that he believes that that was the weapon, was the bridge, meaning getting these girls to the other side where essentially they're trapped, telling them to go down the hill mm-hmm. and on Ron Logan's property. Therefore, no one coming from that side would hear you or see you or hear you scream. And if he had a gun, which they say he did, they found an unspent bullet mm-hmm. in between the bodies. Of course, they're going to be afraid because that was asked. How do you control two young girls? Easy, a gun. Yeah. I mean, maybe if, yeah, I think I would listen to an adult with a gun and maybe not thinking the worst.
Yeah. At this point, have they really confirmed their cause of death? I know we've seen that there's something with a sharp object, but have they said anything about sexual assault? I know one of the, you know, his underwear wasn't found. I know there was all sorts of things like that. What do they specifically know?
I asked Detective Holman, this is, again, early on, not even 2 years after the murders. And he said, I asked about DNA. He said there were DNA. He said, but I'm not saying what kind, because of course there's all kind. And I asked him, were they sexually assaulted? And he hesitated to say, but the consensus was it was a no. And again, information coming in, really not at all, if at all, bits and pieces. But Paul did say to me, look, the sexually motivated crimes don't necessarily involve sexual assault. And he said, it's hard to understand unless you understand that mind and that it's sexually motivated. But how was the sexual, him being a sexual predator? And again, Richard Allen, innocent until proven guilty, but he believes it was a sexually motivated crime based on the crime scene, but it doesn't necessarily equate to sexual assault.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
And it's like,
it's complicated to say the control. People, exactly.
Yeah.
And what I thought, and I asked this to Paul, he was 44 years old at the time. Now he's 50. So, or 51 now, but would someone wake up one day at 44 and do this? Or, and he said he mailed in,
had he done it before?
Had he done it before? Yeah. And he said, well, he could have fantasized about this, Susan. He lived very close to the bridge. Let's say he was down there all the time. He knew the kids had a day off from school.
Yeah.
Let's say he waited for the perfect target. He knew he wanted to murder, but not necessarily who. Right. Because there was also speculation with catfishing and Keegan Klein.
Right.
And Anthony Schatz. And I've been on Court TV several times, and Vinny's like, wait, that's, it could happen because they trace back Libby to having communication with that Anthony Schatz profile that looks nothing as catfishing does.
Right.
It's Keegan Klein. The night before.
Right.
So could that be a coincidence?
They didn't find anything about Anthony Schatz asking her to meet the next day, did they?
Right, right. But then when he was questioned by the authorities, he said, I was supposed to meet her, but she didn't show up, or to that effect. That's not a direct quote. So could it be? And that's when authorities did reach out without saying much more, that if you had any interaction with the at Anthony Schatz profile, please let us know. Mm-hmm. And it had been 5 years. So think about young girls. They may not know or forget.
Yeah.
And who had access to that handle? It turns out this was a former model. He's now a police officer, has two daughters. He feels horrible that his picture was used.
Right.
But it happens everywhere and all the time with catfishing. Yeah. And Libby's grandmother said, you know, Susan, I feel like I failed. And this was on stage in Las Vegas at something called Crime Con, where people can connect and really get the story out there. And Paul did say to her, which I appreciated because I could tell it was weighing heavy on her. Like, I told her not to, that she was at risk, but maybe I didn't say it loud enough. And he said, predators are good at this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
They really are. Mm-hmm. They groom. And Abby and Libby did nothing wrong if they wanted to meet up with, which hasn't been proven, which there's no evidence of it. But they're young girls. They want to have fun. I mean, boys, who doesn't at 13 or 14?
Yeah. And I mean, I interviewed Chris Hansen recently, and it was very similar stuff that he talks about, that you have to really educate your kids, because even when put in that situation, they kind of don't even know what they're getting themselves into. You know, they're at that age where it's fun to meet a boy or fun to do all these things and kind of hide it from their parents or whatever. Yep. So there's a lot of education.
And they have social media. And my daughter just turned 14. I feel like I have to scare her. And maybe it's because I report on this all the time. I said, if you're meeting someone, chances are they're 40 and may kill you.
Right.
So I'm scarring her in another way.
Right.
Because you can never be, I think, too careful. And, you know, back to when I was growing up and my sister and I were playing outside in the back of our house. Did we just hear about it less? I'm not sure. Mm. But there was no indication that there would be a risk down there at the bridge. None.
Right. It's very interesting because in the pictures you see, in the video you see, it's so, you know, you think of these girls as such heroes that they had the wherewithal to say, this doesn't look right. Let me videotape this, whether or not they were thinking in case someone needs to see the evidence later. But, you know, they knew that they felt it was important to get this kind of information and put it somewhere so they can, what you're saying, show their grandfather later or whatever. So let's talk about the case now, because it's gotten very chaotic. So it's been, what, about 6 years? They have arrested somebody. You do a great job in the book of really, like, you know, keeping this all tied up and having it really flow in a way that's understandable. But there have been, as you said, so many parts that people do not understand because the truth really isn't out and probably won't come out until trial. Mm-hmm. So this guy's been arrested, Richard Allen. Everyone's hopeful, thinking that it's great. And by the way, let's talk about that for a second, because I know that you've spoken a lot about the family and where they were when they found out, where you were when you found out. Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned that the family, it wasn't like, oh my God, hurrah, let's jump up. This is a great moment for us. Although great, there's a lot of, you know, just silence at the same time. And, you know, I understand that really well. I lost my fiance, and I remember when they said Osama bin Laden was killed, and they, you know, a couple outlets wanted to interview me, you know, thinking I would be, you know, very excited. Yeah. And, you know, and I was like, time doesn't heal everything. It never will. And that's great, but it doesn't bring back the person.
I just got the chills.
And like you talk about, I didn't know my purpose. Like, to this day, it's hard to figure out why things happen and what your purpose becomes after the fact. Mm-hmm. But I think that's really interesting what you talk about, because their purpose is so important, because there are so many stories that don't get reported. There are so many families that are falling by the wayside, because you hear about the victim, you hear about the killer or who they're looking for, but you don't hear about the families. And I think they have such a big purpose, even more so now, to educate other people about different crimes or missing kids or, you know, and I just found it very interesting what you spoke about their reaction.
You're right. There is this kind of obsession, if you will, with how many Ted Bundy specials have we seen, or the Night Stalker, or that seems to be. And I think people are curious to, are they born or raised killers? So that there's a fascination there, but right, some of the families get left behind in all of this. And I interviewed Becky several times. I became closest with her and Libby's sister, Kelsey. Mm-hmm. And Mike did bring that up early on. It was March. And he said, you know, Abby's family isn't as outspoken. They want me to read a letter from them just to say we respect their way of doing things. Everyone handles grief and tragedy differently. And he said, please respect that. But Becky said to me for several years, year after year, I'd have her on. She'd say, well, I'll tell you, I'm going to come to Atlanta and scream from the rooftops. And I believe that became her purpose. Mm-hmm. Every morning she'd post on Facebook, today is the day, knowing that one day it would be. Yeah. And I called her when I heard someone was arrested, because no one had heard his name. No one was ever charged with the murders, mm-hmm. except Richard Allen. So this, it felt like came out of nowhere. And it felt like they may have a lot. Mm-hmm. Or they could have a lot on this guy, or they do, because he's arrested. Mm-hmm. And no one had been. And I could just, she was at her nephew's wedding, and she said, I'm walking out in the hall. It's what everyone's talking about. And she said, I could tell something was sucked out of her that day, especially the next day when she was able to process it.
Yeah.
And we did a live show on Halloween 2002 to talk about it. She just seemed beaten down and a different type of sadness.
Yeah.
And Paul brought this up, and in hindsight, looking back to that panel, he said, for law enforcement, he said, I've seen it personally. It's a whole different level here. And the justice system is not kind to victims or victims' families. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of tactics, like we were talking about early on, about the opening statements. That's a tactic.
Yeah.
And that's allowed. And you don't have to prove it.
Yeah.
So there was a gag order in this case to prevent that. And that's a whole other topic on this. But Paul did say, you're going to need some help. You're going to need other family members maybe to lean on, people who understand exactly what you're going through.
Right.
Because as you said, they're never coming back.
Right.
No matter who's arrested or who's not, the girls aren't coming back ever. And for Anna's family, for Abby's family, she was her only child. No more waking up early for school, no more planning anything. I mean, just gutted. Delphi was gutted. And those two families were, of course, just the what you're missing. And an arrest, well, they felt better, of course, because their biggest fear was him doing this again.
Yeah.
Because if you could slaughter two young girls, you're capable of anything.
Doing it again.
So they felt good in that way, but it wasn't like,
right,
exhale at all.
And it also brings up, you know, so many people probably assume like they want to have revenge. They want to get this guy. But I don't necessarily know that that's how I felt watching or reading your book and listening to a lot of stuff, because it was more like, a lot of people have given him fairness of, you know, Richard is innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah, yeah.
And they want to see what happened. We want to hear the details. I think that's going to be what's interesting when the trial does finally happen, if it happens, because there's been, let's talk about this, there's been so much chaos from the beginning and from the onset since he got arrested.
Right.
Can you walk us through kind of all the difficulties that have happened?
He was arrested and he said he would hire counsel on his own. He then wrote a letter to the court saying, I didn't know it would cost this much, essentially, in paraphrasing, I need appointed attorneys. So then he was given two attorneys. Mm-hmm. It's Rosie and what is it? Rosie. It'll come to me. So two attorneys. But
something with a B, I think.
Yes. So two attorneys were assigned to the case and they started working on it. And they to the press, they put out this letter saying, Rick didn't do this. He maintains his innocence. Richard Allen calling him Rick. Was that a tactic to say, oh, he's a friendly guy, Rick? That's what people called him. Baldwin is what it is.
Yeah.
And Rosie, it came to me. So, and there was a gag order in this case. So Judge Frangul was assigned to it because the judge who was in Delphi called it, said, use the term, and it's one of my chapters, bloodlust, meaning there's so much attention and so many people wanting the documents. He said, I can't do this. It people are putting up pictures of my wife. It was too much.
Yeah.
Frangul got the case. Now he's assigned attorneys. Well, you're allowed to file motions, of course, that you can do that even with a gag order.
Yeah.
And the motion they did, they claimed it was in a Franks hearing that they said it was an unlawful search of his home because his home, Richard Allen's, was searched. Mm-hmm. And during that particular time in October before his arrest, he did say, yes, I did come out to the conservation officer. That was me. Yep. I did put myself there. So how did they get back to him, I'm wondering? Was it a tip from his wife or daughter? We don't know at this time. So they do a search of his home. Well, the two attorneys are doing what defense attorneys do. They're looking for either mistakes in the investigation. They're looking at the evidence that they have in discovery and saying, in a Franks hearing, this was obtained illegally. Well, the Franks hearing was 136 pages. I think it was just a memorandum disguised as a Franks hearing, really to just get around the gag order. And just the Odinist cult theories were in there. This is the most bizarre thing you will ever read. And I read through it all. And there's mistakes and it seems like almost like chunks. And I will say a defense attorney on court TV was saying to me, now it appears there might be people who believe he's innocent. And of course, there are people who say, well, there's got to be more evidence. Mm-hmm. But in this memorandum, they name names, and you can do that legally. I mean, you can name names. And so it was leaked, the 136 pages.
Right.
And it worked because prior to that, it worked so much, I even forgot to tell you this big part, that he was in prison, and there were, the attorneys wanted him moved out of that prison because innocent until proven guilty, usually in a jail, not that type of prison. They're saying he's treated like a war criminal he's not doing well. Mm-hmm.
And he's lost a ton of weight.
Yes. So they released a picture. But before that, and at a hearing, it was discussed in June that he had confessed several times to his wife and mother. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows that it's recorded. It says it, I believe. It was
on a phone call.
Yeah. And so they stated that in court, both the prosecution and the defense attorneys, that he admitted to this. So you think, okay, is this case closed? Is there going to be a
right,
plea
where
deal?
Are we going with this?
And then all of a sudden, this memorandum is released and everyone forgets about the confessions and everyone is looking at him like, yes, maybe he should be moved. And back to the defense attorney. So everything was released that was released in that apparently had been looked into. The Odinist theory was looked into early.
Uh-huh.
So everything apparently was looked into, but no one was arrested until Richard Allen. Mm-hmm. Well, this, I believe, was put there to create reasonable doubt. I think it did.
But do you think these guys, because they're court appointed, you know, they've been accused of being, you know, basically horrible at their jobs, complete amateurs, even it seems like by the judge who ended up removing them. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that? Do you think that they were doing their job and a good job to try and get this out there, see what sticks and it backfired? Like, what do you think happened there?
I think so. And then apparently someone in Baldwin's office leaked crime scene photos.
Right, which became a huge problem.
Yes, that might have been the final straw for the judge. But there were cameras in the courtroom that day. It was supposed to be a hearing on the Frank's motion. And the attorneys went back in chambers. And now that transcript has since been released. But depending on who you talk to, because he did say, okay, I want these attorneys. And the attorney said, we'll do it for free, pro bono.
Right.
Well, the judge said, no, I can't have you on this case. Now, is that
why?
Up to her? Exactly.
Right.
Like, is it up to her? It's so that.
But it seems like it, she said that because she thought that they were negligent, correct? Is that where you got?
And that? They're fighting back. Two other attorneys were since appointed.
Yeah.
But Rosie, and Baldwin still want to be on the case. So a hearing was set. It will take place in January. To see if, and they even want the judge off the case. They said, we want her off the case.
Do you think they're negligent? Like, what do you think of these attorneys, the original attorneys?
I think that they should have saved the reasonable doubt that they were creating in that document for the opening statement.
Mm-hmm.
I think that where they can do that, you could try it in court, as you will. And that Johnny Cochran did so masterfully.
Right.
In openings in the courtroom.
Yeah, they didn't save outside. Much for mystery.
Right. And jury selection hasn't even happened yet.
Right.
So it's was it negligent? I don't know. We'll see. Should it have been on record outside in the courtroom during that hearing? They said they didn't want to be embarrassed because there were, in so many words, cameras in that courtroom. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting what the Indiana Supreme Court decides in January. I want what's ever best for Abby and Libby's families, and that may be starting with a new judge and new attorneys.
Yeah.
Has so much gone on.
I agree.
That if they keep Judge Gold and they get rid of the attorneys, it's could this be brought up on appeal? I don't know. But it's certainly everything Paul had said is really happening in a way that I didn't even imagine could happen.
Right. So, and it's so interesting because Baldwin, one of the attorneys, as you mentioned, somebody, a former colleague or a friend came into his office, took pictures, gave those to other people who then distributed it online. And then someone ended up killing themselves over it when they were questioned. And the whole thing has just totally gone out of hand.
I even got an email to say, do you want to see them? I said, no, I don't want to see them. And what was very poignant to me is Becky put on Facebook, because they're under a gag order too, I'm sure. And I know that they found solace in telling their stories. I know that helped them, and they can't. And they're following the rules, abiding by the gag order. But she did post a picture of Libby on a blanket. And she says, you know, I take Libby everywhere with me on vacations. And she said, this is how we spend vacation with Libby, how do you spend it? And then she posted pictures of Abby and Libby and said, these are the pictures you should be looking at. She's furious.
Yeah.
And who would blame her? I mean, the crime scene photos being leaked is unbelievable. Should it have been a sanction in public by the judge? Probably. I don't know in terms of technically what should be done, but the trial was supposed to happen in January. That was postponed until next October. But they're fighting for that too, a speedy trial. So a lot could change at that hearing in January.
Has anybody heard from Richard Allen's wife or daughter?
No. Immediately, there was an influx to her Facebook where people wanted to find out who was this person. And they found out he was married, or who is this person and has a daughter. I think because we want to make sense of it. We never really understand why.
Right.
When you tell someone a story about what's on the news, they say, well, why would someone do this?
Right.
There's never a logical answer.
And to the wife, why would they stay?
Or
did they know?
Right.
You know, what did they see?
It seems like you would think, oh, the wife had to have known. But I don't believe that. I've interviewed BTK's daughter several times, Carrie Rawson. She had no idea. Mm-hmm. He would say, don't forget to put air in your tires and make her scrambled eggs and walked her down the aisle. She had no idea.
It was essentially a good dad.
And how do you even go there?
Yeah.
Even if the wife thought his behavior is weird, how do you go from a child killer, a double murderer, someone you thought you knew for more than 20 years, 30 almost? So I don't know if it's compartmentalizing or they're good at that.
Right.
There are some killers that we have seen in the past, serial killers, that are able to keep up a different life.
Right.
And I don't believe.
Or when it's their family, it might, you know, they might be empathetic to their wife and their daughter
person.
And see them totally different than they see women.
They're not like us. They can do, obviously, compartmentalize, and to be able to do it if he did such a horrific crime and then to go on living like nothing happened. Human beings can't really conceptualize that.
I agree with that. I think people cannot understand, and that's why there's so many questions. I mean, even, you know, reverting back to 9/11 for a second, people were like, well, how could these people, you know, fly a plane into the building, but you're not dealing with somebody who believes that life is something to value, and you can't argue with someone like that, right? And also, we didn't have the, this is an awful word to use, but creativity to know that someone would come up with this kind of scheme. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we didn't have the creativity to know that the buildings would fall, you know, yes, structurally. And so you can't kind of look into someone's mind like that unless you really are someone that is built that way, I think. So it's really different. So how are the families feeling now? How are they doing now, Libby?
Because of the gag order, I do keep in touch with Kelsey, mm-hmm, and with Becky, and but I don't ask about the case. I just say, how are you doing?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's so much that I want to know and I want to talk about with them, but I feel that should I not? And that's been difficult, I would imagine, for them. But I interviewed Stacey Chapin. I know you know the college story about the four college, yeah, kids, and Ethan Chapin's mom. And we did a panel together and I got to know her just by reaching out. And she handles this differently, of course, than the Gonzalez's family, because they, when you were earlier talking about like revenge or, mm-hmm, or aren't you excited about bin Laden? And I think everyone handles trauma differently. We saw that with Gonzalez. He'll be in court every single day. Mm-hmm. Stacey said to me, it's not going to bring my son back. I'm not going to court, yeah, to see this monster. It all depends. And I think the way that Becky's family, Libby's family, has, how it's helped them is to get out there and to talk about, yeah, it. Abby's family, not so much. I did meet Abby's grandmother. She was on a panel with me, sorry, and her grandfather. So they were willing to talk about it, but I don't think they got the support as Libby's family got.
Yeah.
Just the way of connecting. And I feel like it really, Kelsey told me that she feels like it did save her life, CrimeCon, to meet Golden State Killer, the people who have been killed, family members, mm-hmm, who really understood what she was going through. Because I could say it, you know someone was murdered, your fiancé. I could say, oh, I understand, I'm so sorry, but you really, it's a connection that no one else can feel. And I think Kelsey got that from connecting with others.
Right. Well, you do have a little bit of a connection to somebody in your family. Your cousin, mm-hmm, was murdered when, yeah, you were younger, right? Can you talk, yeah, about that a little?
Yeah, I was 11 and it stood out to me. It's the Keith family. It's a distant cousin on my dad's side. Mm-hmm. And I just remember them having this wonderful big family. And our good friend, Suzanne, my sister, Eyes, would always talk about her sisters and how they hung around Kathy Keith. And I remember being in the kitchen back in the day with landlines, and my dad was on the phone. And he said, oh my gosh, they found her body. It was found near a dumpster. And my sister and I ran upstairs, and my friend Suzanne told us what she knew, and she was murdered. And no one really talked about it. It wasn't discussed. And I, because of my age, she was in her 20s, I was 11, but we knew her stories, and she lived in our neighborhood.
Yeah.
And so that happened, and I remember at CrimeCon, like we're talking, I told Abby's grandmother, that Diane, and she said, well, you're part of the club. And I said, no. And she said, well, don't downplay your pain.
Yeah.
You can never downplay, because mine isn't, quote unquote, as bad. Maybe this is why you're helping. So that really clicked with me to think, oh, could it have been? Could I have remembered that? Because we did hear details through my friend Suzanne. And now, since I wrote this, and I checked, of course, with the Keefs, with Kelly, her sister, to see if I could put that in there. She didn't want me to, or wouldn't. She said yes. And she said she was crying reading it, because she thought it was well done in terms of talking about their family. It wasn't, quote unquote, salacious, if you will, because, and she said to me, interesting, Susie is what she calls me. Mm-hmm. We didn't really talk about it much either. So I think it's, you don't expect this trauma, and people handle it differently. And what way works,
yeah,
for each person, I don't know. And what is the correct way? I don't even know if there is one.
Yeah. I'm curious how they're feeling about, you know, the upcoming trial. If they want more to just see him, you know, take responsibility, be put behind bars, or if they really want to know what happened. Like, for me, I would want the answers. Mm-hmm. I would want to know what happened in those last moments, what was said. You know, to me, that would feel like closure. You know, for some people, closure is they don't want to hear any of that. They don't want to see the pictures. They just want to know this person can't do it to anyone else.
And I remember walking to the bridge vividly, my first time there with Kelsey, and just coming up to it, this massive structure, and knowing what happened on that bridge. And I said to Kelsey, as we were near the front of the bridge, I said, do you know how the girls died? And she said, no, they're not telling us anything, but I don't know if I really want to know. Mm. So I think she understood that time and forever, how fragile she was in terms of self-blame. She dropped them off. I wish I was meaner that day, or I wish that wasn't as warm out. You go through this. Like, yeah. Could I have changed anything that day?
Right.
And they can't. And that's a never-ending self-torture, I believe.
Yeah. And there's two ways to look at it. You know, some people just want to have that memory of the person looking the way they remember. Once you've seen pictures like that, you can't unsee them, you know? So you want to remember your loved one in a way that you remember them. You don't want to hear the bad things. And then there's people that need to know every detail. Like for me, I've always grappled with the fact that I don't know what happened in those last few minutes and that last hour, you know, with Andy. And that's always kind of haunted me, only for the fact that I really wanted him to know that I found out, like he wasn't alone, you know? Wow. And so when they did eventually find his body about 6 months later, the first thing I said, you have to tell me the cause of death. Like I needed to put together, was he burned? Was he hit in the head? What was he aware when the building fell? You know, so for me, that was super important. But for, you know, his family, they did not want to hear the details.
Was he on the floor with the financial group that where the plane?
He was in the second building that got hit, but the first building that fell. So he was on the 104th floor. And so the first plane went in, you know, to Cantor Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
The second plane went in lower in like the 70s, on the floor, it's in the 70s. So he was above it. So he was, you know, alive for a while until the building fell, unless they got, you know, had smoke inhalation. But, you know, he was in the first bombing in 93, and they were
my friend Suzanne's father was, yes.
And they played poker until, you know, and I imagine, because I was covering it, I was at Bloomberg that day. And I was covering it for news and I wasn't nervous. I was like, well, he'll go upstairs to the roof, you know, he'll, because again, there was we did not know those buildings would fall.
Ever. I mean, I can remember, I'm sure it's etched in your mind forever, but when the buildings fell, were they able to tell you the cause of death?
Yeah, it was blunt force trauma.
Oh, okay. I'm surprised. That's a good thing for you to know, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. It helped me. And that's what I'm saying. For me, it's helpful to hear the details. And sometimes when I watch these murder trials or these criminals, I want to, you know, I'm hoping for the sake of the family that they at least, you know, get the details they want if they want it, because to me that seems really important.
And I said to Mike, it came that he was kind of the speaker of both families, almost put in that position. And I said
to him. And he's the one that found the body.
On stage.
Right?
No, it was a volunteer firefighter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they wouldn't even let Kelsey near
him. They wouldn't.
Once they knew they found the bodies. And I said to him, what keeps you going? And he said, the last 15 minutes of their lives.
Yeah.
And I could tell he was almost thinking about it because he did see Libby's body. And now that we know, right, sharp object, they believe a knife. And and touching on that, only speculation, and based on Paul's experience, it's rare that it's a double murder with a gun. But I believe that was the scare tactic to get them down and maybe pulling
just
it back.
It, yeah.
And there's the unspent bullet. I had to kind of dig into that a little bit in terms of ballistics and how will that play out in court? Of course, you know, covering these trials it's usually a battle of the experts. Someone's going to say it's junk science. Someone else is going to say no. This is absolutely his gun. And there is speculation that there's more that they found at that house. And maybe there is more. Maybe that's why they felt they had to write 136 pages to get everything in that search warrant out and not brought into court.
Right. Okay. So this book was amazing. I read it in a matter of 24 hours, basically.
Thank you.
I loved it. But I, you know, what was your takeaway writing something like this? For me, reading it, it was interesting because I wanted to know about the case, but it was also interesting seeing a news reporter's, you know, almost like your memoir of going through it and taking, you know, a story that much further, getting to know the people behind it, getting to be involved. And even though you weren't personally involved in the case, you really were. You were invested in the case. And I thought that really came through in the book itself. It was a fantastic book.
Thank you. And Becky said that to me, that it was different than she read it. And Kelsey wrote the foreword and she just said it was well done because it's from their perspective.
Yeah.
From going inside of their lives and seeing everything in the highs and lows and kind of what they went through. What was important to me was describing or telling the reader more about Abby and Libby. Mm-hmm. And I did that by, I sat in my room for countless hours, kind of feeling like Tom Hanks on that beach talking to a volleyball. I was in there losing my mind, but I wanted to make sure that I had the essence of Abby and Libby. And I found that through various stories, of course, and video that I had seen through the years. But on Facebook, I found it really apparent with Libby. And just, I went through all of her posts with her Aunt Tara. Mm-hmm. And she'd say, she'd get into Tara's Facebook and say, Libby's my favorite out of everyone. So they had this kind of relationship, and she was funny. And she lived with her grandparents, but very close with her mom. And she'd say, write her little notes or text messages. And she was funny and the kind one and silly. Because what we do see, we saw it with Scott Peterson, with Lacey, there's that one still shot. And I know times have changed in terms of social media, but we only see the wanted poster. It's what you see, Abby and Libby. Abby has a hat on, a straw hat.
Yeah.
And it turns out she made that with her mom, and it was, she had just gone to, or about to go to a wedding, and that's where she wore the hat. So it's more than just that still picture of, oh, these are the victims. It was more of the senselessness of it all. Of course, any murder is, but the girls' lives that they stole, and several family members, Mike included, said that, who knows, they had so much more to give, and they were looking forward to their future, and he was teaching Libby how to drive up and down the driveway. So it's like this, the lives that were cut short, and the crater that's now left in the homes of those family members, essentially killing pieces of them because of this. So it is important, of course, for justice, but they do know. And Becky said to me, what does justice really look like, though? Because they're not coming back. It's not for the girls. They're not. It's you want someone to pay for what they did, but they know it doesn't bring them back. And maybe handing out those flyers, and a big part of contention with many people in terms of law enforcement, they came out with a new sketch in April 2019 of, and Detective Holman called me at that time and said, I saw the special HLN did, and you mentioned the FBI a lot. And I said, well, you're not telling us much. We kind of had that joking relationship. And he said, well, the FBI told us not to do it, not to hold the press conference. And I went, thinking, why? Yeah. Why? Was this a way? And again, speculation, because not everything's out there. Was it a way, because it had been 2 years, to say, okay, something new has to happen here? They invited everyone the size of this room to a press conference, a little bigger. And it's not always open to the public.
Yeah.
But they made you sign in. And this really nice volunteer lady kept saying, did you sign in? Did you sign in? In hindsight, I think they thought he was going to show up. Mm. You know how people insert themselves.
Yeah.
Because the superintendent, Doug Carter, I was sitting, I mean, there were photojournalists behind me, could hear the clicking of the cameras as well. And he said, we've changed direction. We believe you're from Delphi. We believe you live here, once lived here. And we also believe you could be in this room.
Yeah.
And it was like, I mean, if you saw it at home, you'd think, or in a movie, you'd think this would never happen.
Yeah.
And what is this? It happened. Right. And I did a live show from that room for 2 hours, and everyone kind of disappeared. And again, speculating, were they looking at certain houses, or what were they looking for, I wonder? But the superintendent did say to me later, he did think that he was absolutely watching her in the room. And I was a little afraid after, because everyone had cleared out. And I said that to a photojournalist. I'm kind of afraid. He's like, look, I've been around members of ISIS. You're fine. And yeah, they're hilarious, and they've seen everything.
Sure.
CNN. I mean, they're the best of the best, telling stories behind a lens.
Yeah.
So I felt, okay. He's right, he'll protect me. But it was an odd feeling, because again, the town is so small, and you wondered, they're still out there. Who is this, and where is he hiding?
Right.
And if it turns out to be Richard Allen, not far, about a mile away.
At CVS.
Yeah, at CVS.
Filling everybody's prescription.
And for those listening, this is, and I remember Becky telling me this once Richard Allen was arrested, and she had walked down the hall from her nephew's wedding and said, oh my gosh, Tara remembers him. Mm. And you know how if you go to UPS or FedEx or CVS or what have you, you recognize maybe faces, and especially that size. I live in Atlanta. I'm in a bit very different. But she went in there the day of the funeral to pick up pictures of Libby, because to be a certain size,
yeah,
and she was crying. And he said, oh, the pictures are on me.
Wow.
And, you know, she remembers that.
Well, 2024, I think, will be a huge year for getting some understanding for this family and for the people that have been invested in listening to this. So in January, we have a hearing coming up to find out if the lawyers will be put back on, if possibly the judge will be removed, and it'll all start over. And then towards the end of the year, hopefully a real trial will happen. But it'll be very interesting to see what comes out from it. And I want to know if he's been watching the whole time, you know, what he's done, because he's been hiding in plain sight. It'll be interesting to finally get that sort of intel on what he's been doing the last couple of years, and how much his direct family knew or felt.
Yeah, the family did say to me, look, Susan, we want the right person, of course. So if this is the wrong guy, then they want that proven too.
Right.
But why close to 6 years? Right. And there were so many names, as you spoke about, that were brought up. Why now? Something must connect him, I think, bigger than the bullet.
Yeah.
And we'll see that in court. But I do believe whatever it takes, because everyone has the same mission, whether it's a different judge, same judge, different attorneys, same attorneys, is let's get this going.
Yeah.
So it can be resolved. Resolved is a bad word in terms of it ever going back to the way it was, but some sort of justice.
Yeah. All right. So over the years, what are some other stories that you have been really taken by?
I remember this is way back. And when I spoke about my first job as a reporter, besides the lawn bowling, Samantha Runyon was taken and murdered. And I remember speaking to her mom and, of course, Polly Klass. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know.
Of course.
Father becoming an advocate and just
talk about purpose. That's what he turned that into.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you really see, like, this is that one act and this horrific a murder and him losing his daughter. It's almost as though that gives them strength. I have found through connecting. And that's why Abby's family, I believe, said to me, Diane said, don't dismiss your pain or lessen your pain, because there is the common ground is something's happened to everyone. Maybe not to this degree. It's happened to you. You've been able to connect with so many people. So it's a way of understanding what someone's been through. And you could only get that if you've been through it.
Right.
So I think the stories that stood out to me were the ones that we see with Polly Klass. And of course, Gabby Petito's family I've gotten close to. Joe Petito. And he knows. He said this to me because you mentioned it. There's some cases that don't even get talked about.
Yeah.
For some reason. So why? And I was asked that question. I did a panel with him and his family. And they said, I don't know why. We do understand that Gabby touched the world, and that, I don't know, it was because there were social media, or I believe it was the body cam footage. And once someone said, because I saw it differently. I was in the newsroom then, a colleague and friend of mine, Sammy, about young 30s guy, and he saw it very differently. I thought it was clear as day that she was being abused and calling out for help. He didn't see it. Mm-hmm. So it's how you saw that. And so I think that really played a role. But since then, the Petitos have been working to get the not so known cases or reported on cases known. And he said, that's my purpose.
Right.
And he said, I can't watch that body footage. The body can't. He's watched pieces of it. And he says, I will if I have to. But this was a couple of years back. He said, that's not the Gabby I knew. And she hid stuff from us, of course, as girls do, as domestic violence victims, who it was assessed from that body cam footage that she had been going through this, that he said, I would fall into a deep depression if I thought, what could I have done differently?
Sure, of course.
So I think the stories like that, where it's people that you get to meet, sadly, through the most horrific circumstances that have happened to them, but to see the strength that they have to have, and that plays out differently, and no one's strong every day, no one.
Yeah.
And he said, my darkest hours are ugly. So it's how you can get up and keep going. And that's where I found my connection. And looking up to Abby and Libby's family, it's like, if they can still be standing, you can get through anything.
Is there one case that's haunted you that you kind of want to follow up with and see where it's going, or a case that you're following right now that you're really, you know, waiting to see what happened, or you're just so obsessed with it? Like for me, that Lori Vallow.
Oh,
case
yes.
was, I could not get enough
I
of
think
that.
I mentioned Vallow accidentally
when I was talking
about the attorneys, the Day Beller. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
The twists and turns there.
Yeah.
I mean, that story.
And I couldn't believe that people weren't connecting the dots, you know, first when her ex-husband died, then the brother died, then the wife died, then, you know, all these things are happening. And I'm like, why is no one talking about this in the same breath? And why is no one getting her, you know? I was just, it was so infuriating.
Mike Alano's former colleague of mine laid it out perfectly. It was so confusing. Mm. And I had interviewed JJ's grandparents. That was horrific to see what they were going
through. Oh, yeah.
That little boy and what happened to him. And what stuck with me in the most devastating, gutting way was Chris Watts, when we heard exactly how he told it. I mean, what do you believe?
Yeah.
Really? But that he tried to kill his two little girls once and they got up and then he killed them again, or there's speculation, were they dead prior? But I feel like the prosecutor in that case wanted the details out there for whatever reason. I know that it was death penalty was off the table. So maybe it was a way to have prisoners hear about exactly how horrific this thing was. I don't know, but it was word for word read. And I was on the set with attorney Joey Jackson, who else was with me, former law enforcement. And I just, it really got to me. And I it was covered by video, of course, and I had to point to Joey to keep to talk about this. Mm. And of course, Sandy Hook. I think anytime young kids are involved, it's jarring. It's but right, the Lori Vallow.
When you're talking about Chris Watts, you know, that's an example. He was married to Shanann, who he killed because he was having an affair, essentially, and then put his two daughters in an oil rig. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was an example to me of how you never know what a murderer looks like. He was this
that's
handsome,
a great point.
You know, energetic looking guy, and people really wanted to believe him when he did. You know, he spoke all over the place about trying to bring her home. And, you know, if we watch anything on the ID network, we always know to look at the spouse.
Yeah, exactly.
They're checked the
family annihilators. There's no word for it because people think normal human beings, why not just get divorced? Well, they don't want that. They don't want any. They feel like,
right.
And that they annihilate the family and get rid of everyone in the family. And right with Chris Watts, and that was an excellent point you spoke about, because if it does turn out to be Richard Allen, monsters don't look like monsters.
Yeah.
They don't look like Charles Manson, who I believe looks like. About, right. They don't. They could be the guy
who's
living
Ted Bundy.
Next door. Yes.
And that guy that you're hoping will swipe on you on
Bumble. And one that you get in his car on campus. He pretended to have a broken arm.
Right.
You believe
I would have gotten in his car.
Right? It's like, wait a minute. And you're studying law and you seem charismatic.
Right. He was great in court.
Yes. It doesn't make you think, who do you really know?
Yeah.
And I think that's the most frightening part. And I think people are fascinated by it in a way, who are drawn to crime, not in for a voyeuristic way, but a way I believe, especially women, which is crime class 90% women, is a way of maybe protecting yourself or feeling like, well, how do we know? And are there signs? And we're always looking for them.
Yeah. One quick question, because I know Mark Garagos is trying to get a new trial for the Menendez brothers. What do you think of that?
Oh, my gosh. So, quick backstory. Grew up in New Jersey, and my sister and I played tennis pro Merrick. And he was friends with the Menendez brothers because, you know, the Princeton connection. And Merrick, and it was Lyle. The older one, not Lyle. Stuff by my house, came inside. This was weeks before the murder. My dad met him. We weren't home, my sister and I. So that was always in my head when I follow this. But I think differently now than I did back then. I remember the People magazine cover. And I went to high school in Princeton, and there was a Chuck's. That's what they bought, the wing place, Chuck's. Mm-hmm. And they bought a roll. But it never made sense to me. And I was too young to really think thoroughly through this. And, of course, gunning down your parents, they admitted to it.
Yeah.
But if they already had the wealth, why would they wouldn't murder their parents, what I believe now, for money? They lived in that wealth. So why? It's not the Rolex or the wings that they got. Now, I do believe that Jose was sexually assaulting his kids.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric, time and time and time and time again. And I think when he was going to UCLA and they said, you have to live here. I believe that he was a predator. Do I think it's okay to kill your parents? Absolutely not. They've been in prison more than 33 years. I think it's time that they get let out. That's my opinion on it. And I do believe as a society, we're more willing to see this abuse or understand it. Instead of Giorgio Armani suits on the cover of People saying murder in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
I fell into it. I read it. I understand that. Of course, it's not right. But I think what played into that was OJ walking. And there was a kind of a bone to pick in terms of they can't lose another case.
Yeah.
Prosecutor. So, but I do believe that abuse took place. And I recently spoke to the gentleman behind the documentary that was recently released on Peacock about Menudo.
Oh, right.
And one of the brothers, and I reached out to him and he said, thank you. And he covered both cases and just talks to the brothers constantly and really wants to uncover. He believes, based on his reporting, that there was more abuse by Jose, more young kids.
Yeah, more. Right.
And I think just the one Menudo member who came out and said, no, I was sexually abused by Jose.
Mm-hmm.
I think that should play in. And I hope it does. I hope they're let out.
Yeah.
That's a case I have been obsessed with and following because of how it's turned.
Yeah.
Maybe the knowledge that we have. They pled they said they did it.
Yeah,
and they right. explained why. I don't think looking at them, speaking of how murderers look, that it was just, and the evidence that wasn't allowed in mm-hmm. by the cousins and the family.
Letter. Yeah.
Yeah. So I believe that 33 years they should be let out based on
or at least given a new trial to see them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And to hear all of the evidence.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's too bad that Nancy Grace isn't on every night anymore because she always had a new story for us to follow
always.
And obsessed
and,
with.
And top mom. And I mean, Jodi Arias, we covered that.
Oh, yeah.
The interest was there. 17 days on the stand. You know, it's what are people capable of? Why do they do it? And how much this guts everyone around them.
And that's another example of how murderers don't look like murderers because Jodi was this pretty girl. Right?
That you would, why would she kill Travis Alexander, have her camera with her? And luckily, pictures were on that camera.
Yeah. But Nancy's, you know, team was so good at picking
so
out
good.
Such good stories. I remember, I don't know if you remember this name, Jasmine Fiore. She was, she had married in Vegas a guy who had been on some reality show and she was missing. And they ended up finally identifying her through her boob job. And he had taken out her teeth and she was missing. And then he went on the run and ended up killing himself. But Nancy was so obsessed with this story.
And
I was obsessed with this story because I was obsessed with Nancy. But when I first moved to Vegas, Jasmine came to me and asked to rent a room for me. And she said she was a real estate agent. She wasn't. She was, you know, I found out later she was a little more than that in Vegas and got herself into some trouble. So she ended up leaving, you know, my house. But I knew her. And to watch Nancy with someone that I knew really drew me in. And I, you know, could not stop following. Just on all her shows, you know, we couldn't stop following everything she spoke about.
And she, coming from her experience and talking about connecting and having her fiancé killed, I believe that she had a rare connection of wanting, she was almost.
She wanted the truth.
To get the bad guy. She wanted the person to pay who did this.
Yeah. And she had a lot of.
Yes.
You felt that anger coming through or that unresolved, you know, like we've got to get to the bottom of this.
She
wanted to make people aware of the story.
Yep.
Because what was so important, she did such a good job, especially with the top mom situation, but she would always talk about Kaylee, is that the kid's name, and always show those pictures. I remember those videos and she did a great job of really having you remember the person while you're listening to all the gruesome details. But that's also why, you know, I for now 23 years or whatever it's been, have continued, you know, people will ask me the story about 9/11. Everyone's heard it a million times, but I love to share the story because I want people to know Andy's name so that he, you know, he didn't die 23 years ago. People really felt like they knew him. And that was always important to me. And so many, you know, over time, people will be like, why are you still talking about this? Well, it's in my bones, but it's not about me.
Right.
You know, people think that when I'm talking about it, I make it about me. I do it so people know his name and so he's not forgotten.
That's judgment that shouldn't be given because no one knows exactly what it feels like to be, to go through that.
Yeah.
We've all seen the picture of you devastated looking for him. It's horrific. There's no timeline to get over. You'd never get over it. There is no timeline. And that was Becky's biggest fear, that the girls will be forgotten. She said, Susan, it's little things. I got the insurance card. Her dental insurance, her name wasn't on there. And she said, I don't want people to forget her. Yeah. So they did build this Abby and Libby Memorial Park. It started as an idea for like a softball field, and now it's an amphitheater. And people can go donate there, and you could have a personalized paver for even Andy, someone you think about. And it's just a way that, okay, they won't be forgotten.
Right.
The pictures are there. So the families were able to connect. And quickly here, there was a gentleman early on in the process, all volunteers. He showed up with this huge tractor, and he was in, and he was helping. And Abby's grandfather was thinking, Eric, who is that guy? Like, he's doing a lot, but we don't know who he is. And went over and he said, my brother was murdered 30 years ago. We never found out who did. So he was helping. So that, I believe, in the way humans connect and heal through each other, they can, without judgment, without, I mean, it's just sick of what can go on, the lowest of the lows. You can hide behind nothing, not your picture on YouTube, and speculate. Family. It's, I mean, that's just asinine for clicks.
Yeah.
But there's a side of this that I've met and I've seen firsthand where they connect and they're lifelong friendships and I believe holding each other up.
Yeah. Yeah. Will you be at the trial next year when it eventually happens?
Yep. I'll be at the hearing in January.
Oh, good.
I'll call you after.
Oh, good. I can't wait to hear. Where can people find your book?
Ooh, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and stores near you. The easiest way is Bezos, where I get everything these days, don't we all?
This is the book, you guys, down the hill. You should absolutely try it. Read it. You will go through it in very quickly. It was phenomenal. It was so great seeing you. Thank you so much for being here. And hopefully I'll have you on soon, because I would love to have your take on different trials that come up too, because it's so fun to get your thoughts on it. And so many times I think people have a hard time with news these days because there's not enough information, and you turn on all the stations and they're regurgitating the same information over and over and over. Even in the Gilgo Beach stuff, you know, people were just making up stuff and just repeating it. Yeah. And it'll be nice to sort of push that forward, especially into 2024, and hear some of the details that have happened. I'd love to hear the details on what happened, you know, on this later on with you and some of the other trials
Idaho,
that might be coming up.
I'm thinking of Stacey Chapin, of course, but Koberger. And so there are trials that it will be interesting to see.
And speaking of that, just really quickly, I had Mark Garagos on and I asked him about Brian Koberger. Is that how you say his name? And he thinks from a criminal defense perspective, he has a good case. So it'll be interesting to see what they, you know, what defense they give him.
Right. And but Mark thought,
you know, there's a way out for him. So it'll be interesting.
I know if anyone knows, it's Mark, we'll see. And that, of course, can happen during the trial, but where I believe the mistakes were made with Richard Allen's former attorneys, where it's being played out to the public and picking the
jury. The jury,
it's going to be tough. It gets more difficult as we have more technology. We're on our phones. Mm-hmm. We see everything. So I just want it to be a fair trial.
Yeah, I'm always hoping I'll be picked for a trial like that. But of course, I'm the last person they'd pick because I read too much about it.
Now that you said it, you're not going to be picked.
But you could be fair no matter what, I believe it.
Yeah, I would try to be.
All right, well, thank you so much. Again, everybody get her book, Down the Hill, and we will have you on again soon.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.